Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Rachel Pagonis, and I'm your host for this episode. Today, I'm speaking with Catherine Carroll about her new book, Building Schools Making Doctors, Architecture and the Modern American Physician, published by University of Pittsburgh Press in May of this year, 2022. Catherine Carroll is an architectural historian based in Albany, New York. Support for her research has come from the Graham Foundation for Advanced Studies in the Fine Arts, the Henry Luce Foundation, American Council of Learned Societies, the Francis A. Countway Library of Medicine, and the Rockefeller Archive Center. She's presented widely on medical school design and taught most recently at Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. She holds a bachelor's degree from Williams College and a PhD from Boston University. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm really delighted to have you here speaking to us about your book. And would you begin by telling us a bit about your background and how you came to write about architecture and medical schools?
Well, I'm trained in the history of art and architecture, so I'm not, by formal training, a medical historian, which means that I came to architecture and medicine through the lens of architecture. I was living in Boston and was introduced to Harvard Medical School's campus, which, for those who aren't familiar, it's the heart of the campus is this large, imposing, five-building marble quadrangle. And I started to do some research on it. From there, you know, fast forward more than a decade, and the project grew tremendously to become national in scope. And I came to recognize that in the late 19th and early 20th century, medical education and medical school design transformed simultaneously in a way that was deeply intertwined. And what became so exciting to me about this project was the opportunity to engage with themes from many from a wide spectrum. So architecture and science, pedagogy, patronage, race, gender, and this breadth is really what made it both very exciting and also quite challenging.
So it started with the Harvard Quadrangle.
Yes, many years ago.
Which, if anyone's seen it, it's definitely an impressive place. So your period of study begins in 1893, and that's when Johns Hopkins Medical School decided to erect a specific kind of campus based on the Institute Plan. And would you explain what the Institute Plan was and what made this a particularly significant event?
So the opening of Johns Hopkins Medical School in 1893 is typically cited as the inauguration of the format of medical training roughly still in place today. So 2 years of basic science education followed by 2 years of clinical instruction. When I started to dig into the archives, it became very clear that from the early days of this pedagogical transformation in medical training, architecture was at the center of the conversation. Medical educators who were involved in this change believed that the design of the buildings would shape the type of work undertaken in their halls and ultimately impact the type of physicians and researchers that the schools produced. Johns Hopkins Medical School, along with the faculty at Harvard Medical School and a handful of other places, decided to draw on what they had seen studying in Germany. And what this meant was that they divided their campuses into separate buildings, with each building devoted to a specific subject or two. And they called this the institute design. Now, this was a departure. The decision to construct separate buildings challenged the prevailing design in the US, which at the time focused on creating a single building for medical training. The faculty who championed the institute design celebrated the conceptual and physical autonomy between the different areas of science, so anatomy, physiology, pathology, etc. Where this, I think, becomes maybe takes a surprising twist is that the institute design never becomes widespread. Only a handful of schools adopted it, but I begin with it in the book because the champions of this design came from elite schools and were very, very vocal. And so the influence in the institute design continues to heavily inflect the conversation about how a medical school building should be designed for decades. And so in a kind of general sense, it sort of has an outsized impact for the number of schools that construct the institute plan or the institute design. But because it is so seminal, it really requires a deep dive.
And did those schools then stay with the institute plan, or did they later abandon it?
Oh, that's a great question. So essentially, once it was in stone, so to speak, it was very expensive and very difficult to change. But for Harvard, for example, decades later, the dean writes this letter and says, you know, we've essentially had to do our best to build bridges where there were no bridges, is sort of what he says, and to bring the campus up to date because this original idea is no longer what we're trying to do here. And so they modify what they have, but it's still a challenge to do because of the limits of architecture and the construction themselves. There's also another letter where someone who's reviewing medical schools in the 1930s writes that one, he doesn't name the school, but one of the institute design schools had considered entirely abandoning the campus and starting over again. That doesn't ever happen as far as I know, but it was definitely a challenge for the schools who had these buildings.
Yeah. Oh, that's pretty radical to abandon the whole.
Yeah. Like I said, I don't think that ever happened, but it was even an idea, I think, speaks to the frustration that the faculties were having.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to their belief in the impact of architecture.
Yes. So there were so many different aspects of medical education and building design that came up in this book. And one thing that struck me is that many of us may not associate museums with doctors in training. So what was the role of museums in medical schools, and why did they become obsolete?
Well, at the turn of the 20th century, as part of what I keep referring to as this transformation in medical education, nearly every medical school in the country rebuilds its facilities. And I break these facilities into two general categories. There's the institute design, which I've mentioned, and then what I call the unified plans, or single building designs, where all of the spaces are housed under one roof. These designs would have differed dramatically in their campus footprints, but they had a lot in common in terms of what they housed within the buildings. In both cases, the facilities would have been much, much larger than the school's previous homes. We had just mentioned Harvard, so I can say that that is a 5-building quadrangle, and each of those 5 buildings was larger than the school's previous home. So that gives you a sense of how dramatically these schools were growing. And within these spaces, they had many, many facilities, which were often quite new. So they have much more extensive laboratories, storage for cadavers, housing for research animals, library facilities, lecture halls. And one component of this very multidimensional building was often a museum. So the reason to have a museum, which I should back up and say was a collection of typically anatomical or pathological material or both, and then sometimes also skeletons, models, medical instruments, portraits, that type of thing might be included in the museum. But the purpose of these collections was to allow students and faculty who are engaging in education and research to study typical, atypical, or diseased body parts. What happens is medical museums predate medical school reform, the medical school reforms in the late 19th and early 20th century, but the faculties retain them because they provided another opportunity for hands-on learning. And hands-on learning was one of the real kind of critical components of reformed medical training. So especially if a school was struggling to obtain cadavers and had limited opportunities for dissection, museums could be critical hands-on educational tools. But by the 1920s and 1930s, faculty increasingly don't see museums as significant for education and research. And there's a lot of reasons for why that happens, but I can give you just a few examples. First, faculty prefer so-called fresh material rather than preserved specimens. And fresh material by this point was easier to obtain. In addition, shifts in research directions made the museum less relevant. Another component is that the quality of textbook photographs or illustrations was improving, which may have limited the utility of the museum. So you can see how sort of from many different directions, the museum becomes less relevant. By the 60s, you know, then the faculties had really sort of reassigned these museum spaces to other uses. So they sort of start to become less relevant by the 30s, but then over the next several decades, the spaces get reassigned.
Yeah. Oh, and I was just going to ask, were they ever visited by members of the public?
Oh, okay. So on occasion they were, but when you look at the floor plans, they really weren't put in places that were very accessible generally. So yes, there are a few examples where, you know, they were designed with the public in mind, but that was certainly the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah. Great. Well, in chapter one, let's start from chapter one. You note that science has held different meanings throughout medical history. But in the 19th century, it became largely associated with laboratory science. So I'm wondering, what was the relationship between science, medical school design, and medical practice in the late 19th and early 20th centuries?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. On the most basic level, the shift toward laboratory science, and we can add to that also the embrace of new technologies such as the X-ray in the clinical setting, required a change in how students trained. In other words, they had to learn first to value the new laboratory techniques, how to use them in the clinical setting, and quite frankly, in this period, how to literally run the tests themselves. They weren't often handing that off to someone else. So it makes sense that we would expect that if you construct new medical schools across the country, which is what happened, and these facilities provide extensive resources for laboratory training, then students will practice medicine differently than their counterparts who hadn't received that training. I think where the research becomes thornier is that medical educators in the period argued passionately that the different types of medical school design would impact how students practiced medicine. So if we return to this example of the institute design versus the unified designs, medical faculties believe that these variations in design would impact how students conceptualize science and eventually how they practice medicine. In their minds, students who learned in unified buildings, where all the subjects were aligned under one roof, would conceive of the medical sciences as an integrated whole rather than as the sort of discrete subjects promoted by the institute design. But we don't have great methods for documenting the impact of this thinking. But just because we can't necessarily document how that played out, I don't think we can ignore it. Because, you know, if for no other reason, then this belief contributed to the prominence of the unified designs in the U.S. in the early 20th century. And the piece I didn't tell of the story earlier is that, you know, we have unified designs, then we have this really vocal group of faculty who are trying out the institute design, but then ultimately it shifts back to the unified designs in terms of what is being promoted. So these beliefs really inflect those decisions.
That's really interesting, because that unified design and seeing science, medical science, as an integrated whole, because it seems like more recently medical science has become very disparate again, with all the different specialties.
Well, and I think, you know, when we put this in historical context, in the around the turn of the 20th century, this is when the specialties are really burgeoning, right? You didn't really have specialization before this time period. And so when you even look in terms of the number of departments within medical schools in these decades, they grow tremendously. And so there's certainly an anxiety about this for a lot of people, a concern about this. And I think that we need to see the unified designs as a pushback against specialization in many ways.
So the Flexner Report in 1910, as many of our listeners will know, had a huge impact on medical education. But as you tell it, it also had an influence on medical school design. How did the report influence medical school design?
Well, what was certainly a surprise to me, and maybe a surprise to the listeners as well, is that Abraham Flexner was very invested in buildings. He cared about buildings. He thought about buildings a lot. His correspondence at the GEB, he's often talking with the schools that he is supporting about the buildings, the GEB being the General Education Board. I'm jumping a little bit forward in his life. But beginning in his report, or really while he was undertaking the research for the report, Flexner centers physical space and medical school design. There are six categories that Flexner uses to evaluate medical colleges for the Flexner Report, and two of them were laboratory and clinical facilities. And when you go through his comments and you start to compile his comments in these areas, he's advocating consistently for clean, well-organized schools with extensive laboratory space and affiliated hospitals with adequate patient volume. He's also promoting placing all 4 years of medical training on one physical campus. To us today, these ideas probably seem rather basic, but as we know, few schools met Flexner standards in 1910, and these were really very progressive ideas. Later in the decade, as I alluded to previously, he begins working for the General Education Board, the GEB, where he leads their medical education program, and he allocates funds for a number of medical school construction projects, which gave him the opportunity to put in place many of the ideas he outlines in the Flexner Report. And typically other philanthropic foundations follow his lead.
And I wonder, because if I recall correctly, you write that it's not really clear who chose him to have this role that he played in medical education. So could you tell us just a bit about his background, who he was?
Sure. So he is from Louisville, Kentucky. He goes to Johns Hopkins, gets his undergraduate degree, returns to Louisville, runs as the head of a private school. I think for something like 19 years, it's a long time. Before he then leaves and goes to Harvard, where he gets a master's degree. He writes a book, and ultimately is hired as you say, for not very clear reasons, by the Carnegie Foundation to undertake this survey of medical schools across the United States and Canada, and ultimately shows that he's very adept at these types of surveys. And this really launches him into doing some work for the Rockefellers. He ultimately then becomes part of the General Education Board, working, which is a Rockefeller Foundation, is there until 1928, then goes on to a whole other career. So he has this very, very dynamic and changing career, and is certainly great deals have been written about him. And there's much to learn there.
Yeah. And we'll get back to the General Education Board in just a little bit. But I want to ask something else first, which is about the medical school hospital or teaching hospital. I think that's something that we today are all familiar with. It's embedded in our notion of healthcare even, but it wasn't always that way. So how did the medical school hospital come to be, and what was the underlying idea there, and how did it manifest architecturally?
A teaching hospital is a hospital where medical students and residents learn. It can have any design. It's not just the medical school hospital, but one type of teaching hospital is a building type that I termed the medical school hospital hyphenated. And in these cases, in the case of this particular design, medical educators took the idea of physical and conceptual unification beyond just the preclinical subjects, and I applied it to the entire four-year medical school curriculum. So the architectural result was incredibly complicated. It was a building that put under one roof all of the facilities for preclinical training, from anatomy to, to the full physiology, the full spectrum of the preclinical subjects, and then all of the clinical facilities, from the emergency room to the surgical suite, entirely under one roof. And this design became very popular beginning in the mid-1920s. And the underlying idea was that it would encourage students and faculty not only to understand the branches of medicine as a unified whole, but in particular to align the laboratories with the clinic. And again, you know, we had mentioned specialization earlier, and there's so much concern about, you know, are the preclinical scientists talking and faculty talking to the clinical faculty, and how do we create collaboration and integration? And so this was meant to be an architectural impetus to encourage that type of communal discourse.
And did it?
well, that is a really great question. I think there are certainly faculties that say, yes, it absolutely did. The Vanderbilt faculty, that's one example of a medical school hospital, and they were very pleased and talked a great deal about how it contributed to their scientific efforts, and they said yes. But it's more complicated than that. There are also many indicators that changing the architecture does not necessarily change people's behavior. And I go into a lot of specific examples in the book, but it's much easier to create architectural change than necessarily to change a pedagogical ethos. And so it is not as clear cut as that.
Yeah. No, I can imagine. So I'd like to go back to the General Education Board. And in chapter 3, it's really interesting. You describe how donors, including private philanthropists and foundations, became critical to the construction, or indeed to the survival, of medical schools. But as you describe it, just one of them, which is the General Education Board, or the GEB, left a lasting mark. And I'm particularly interested in the GEB's influence on medical colleges for women and Black medical students. So would you tell us about that?
Sure. I think backing up just a little bit, many individual philanthropists and foundations left a lasting mark. But what separated the GEB was its national program and the scale of its work. And we need to remember that in this time period, there's no federal funding for medical education. And so the GEB was really the only organization that was crafting this kind of national agenda, and then contributed to the construction efforts of 15 medical schools around the country. So there's just no one else who's leaving as sort of broad a footprint as the GEB is. As we've mentioned already, Abraham Flexner was the one responsible for the GEB's program in medical education, and the GEB's program, not surprisingly, grew out of the ideas that he had outlined earlier in the Flexner report, including very specific ideas about the education of white women, Black men. Simply put, he didn't support single-sex education for women. In the Flexner report, he advised potential donors who wanted to support women in medicine to support co-educational institutions. In his language, something to the effect that if you support a co-educational institution, then the benefits would be shared by men without a loss to women students. Of course, there's a lot that we could dig into with that quote. there's a lot there. Suffice to say, he was not going to then support a single-sex school for women when they approached the GEB. Only one single-sex school for women, Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania, survives the period of medical education reform. They do approach Flexner, and Flexner turns them down for financial support. No major donor is willing to support Women's Medical College, and particularly its efforts to create a modern medical school building. It finally is able to open a new building in 1930, but it is then saddled by a substantial loan that they took out to create the building, and the facility is very small. The faculty to create this very small structure cut dedicated research space from the building program. And this is really problematical because this is the same period when research increasingly serves as the primary barometer for individual and institutional recognition. So sort of just as research is really becoming this big thing, Women's Medical College can't keep up, doesn't have the facilities to support this, and it becomes a handicap. At the same time, the sort of second piece of this building program is that while Women's Medical College provides its students with comprehensive medical training across all the specialties, the building is designed to emphasize the specialties most closely associated with women physicians: obstetrics, gynecology, pediatrics, and public health. And as we have kind of hinted at already, space is rarely as flexible as designers like to think. And so codifying these types of gendered associations has a long impact. You also asked about historically Black medical colleges. Some Black women did train at Women's Medical College, but more trained at Howard University and Meharry Medical College, which are the two historically Black medical schools in the U.S. that survived the era of medical education reform. And in the Flexner Report, Flexner infamously advises philanthropists to support only Howard and Meharry at the expense of this country's other five Black medical colleges, all of which close. Once he's at the GEB, Flexner extends aid only to Howard and Meharry, but he allocates far more money to Meharry because he sees Howard as a purview of the federal government, which did provide it with some financial support. So for this reason, in my research, I focus on Meharry, also because it gives the opportunity to compare two Nashville medical schools. Just a few miles apart in Nashville, we have Meharry for Black students and Vanderbilt for white students. And both receive tremendous funding from the General Education Board. The General Education Board heavily supported their construction campaigns, which take place just a few years apart. Both end up constructing the same type, which is that medical school hospital combined under one roof. But they're very, very different structures. Not surprisingly, the Vanderbilt facility, more is spent per square foot on the building. The building provides more square footage per student than at Meharry. To put it really bluntly, it's just a nicer facility at Vanderbilt. But it goes much deeper than that. Members of the GEB did not conceptualize Black physicians as medical scientists, and so they fund very, very little research space at Meharry, which is a stark contrast to the robust facilities for research that are constructed at Vanderbilt. At the same time, at Meharry, although they are training students in all areas of medicine, there is this real emphasis on public health outreach, which is supported physically, architecturally, by this very large public health lecture hall, donor-funded, that really encapsulates this idea that that at Meharry there'll be this emphasis on public health outreach. Now, interestingly, at Vanderbilt, the GEB is very committed to public health. They're concerned about public health in the South in general, so they want to support public health in Nashville. But at Vanderbilt, it takes a completely different format where they want to support a research program. They want Vanderbilt to create this new innovative teaching technology, model, I should say. And so, this very different conception of what medical education meant for Black students and white students, and then how that is promoted by the building itself.
Wow, that's really interesting. That sounds like it could be a topic of a book in itself.
That chapter just kept getting longer and longer and longer. No, I think that's true. And I think, you know, it's worth pointing out that not every medical school predominantly or exclusively for white men had the funding for a major research program and exceptional facilities. But Black men, Black women, and white women had no schools that met these criteria. You know, Meharry, Howard, and Women's Medical College were critical sites for training medical students and really essential faculty opportunities that weren't available elsewhere, but they didn't have the resources to construct the facilities on par with the schools for their elite white male counterparts.
Yeah. And so essentially they weren't meant to be the ones going out and doing the research.
Right. And this idea that, the schools were promoting very specific specialties as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So in chapter 4, which is called School Buildings and Marketing of Modern Medical Education, you describe how buildings were used to shape or modify public opinions. I'm learning. It's just fascinating how buildings have shaped different things. But one example involves two controversial components of medicine, experimental animals and cadavers. So could you tell us what was the background to the controversy over those two things? And how did building designers react or compensate to it?
So yes, absolutely. Buildings are such active cultural participants. I think that a lot of us don't necessarily think of them that way, but I'm so excited that you're recognizing that and to talk to you about these ideas. So medical schools depended on community support. They needed community support for patients, for funding, for students, employees. And they recognized that specific aspects of medical training made some members of the public, of the non-medical community, uncomfortable. They wanted to use the buildings then to help mitigate this discomfort as much as possible, because they want a lot of public support. And one of these areas was animal experimentation. Medical educators worried about decreasing public support, you know, for all the reasons I just mentioned, but in the case of animal experimentation, also because of the fear that if the public really came out against animal experimentation, that there could then be legislation that would curb or prohibit the use of animals in the laboratory. And so physicians wanted to use the buildings as a way to help appease or ease, I guess I should say, ease these concerns. And so when you start to dig into the archival documents, first there's the fear that really terrible spaces for animals, not only is that, you know, and they say this, not only is that, you know, morally repugnant, but they fear that that could really raise the anger of the public. And they describe really awful sounding conditions in some places with leaking roofs and poor ventilation and lack of heat in the winter and just really terrible spaces. And so the articles, as they're putting out these new buildings, as they're promoting these new buildings to the public, which was a huge part of the construction agendas, would detail in kind of, to me at least, sort of surprising levels of detail, the animal spaces in these buildings. And they would go into depth about the light and the ventilation and the heating and how they would be cleaned and what the diet for the animal was. One school says, you know, where every dog gets a dog biscuit every day. And there's another, you know, this is clearly, I think, has to be hyperbole, but, you know, one medical dean writes that the animal quarters are even comparable to patients, you know, facilities in a modern hospital, right? So they're, you know, they're clearly trying to shed this in the, you know, best possible light. But then there's also just this element, not only of creating what they hope will be facilities that are beyond reproach, but just not making them too visible. So they tend to house the animals discreetly. They are usually placed in the roofs, on roofs, in basements. When there's a standalone animal house, it's typically, you know, on kind of the back edge of the medical campus, away from the more public spaces, or one school constructs a row of trees to put in front of the animal house. So just sort of also capitalizing on the kind of out of sight, out of mind hope, at least. And that sort of out of sight, out of mind is also really permeates the buildings in terms of anatomy and dissection. Some members of the public registered their discomfort with dissection of human cadavers. And so the buildings were designed to transfer bodies as discreetly as possible. On the interior, this often meant a separate elevator for cadavers, for anatomical material. In one school, they even created a separate corridor that ran sort of parallel to the main hallway into the anatomy suite to move cadavers. On the exterior, this meant things like separate enclosed entrances, again, strategically placed trees to help shield the arrival of cadavers from the neighbors. And when a dissection laboratory was on the ground floor, invariably these spaces would have opaque windows. Historical photographs reveal that in some cases, even the windows in the dissecting rooms would only open from the top so that, you know, passersby couldn't inadvertently view a dissection in process. And so I think we really need to understand these buildings as actively participating in marketing medical education to the public by creating these strategic designs that help to minimize the controversial elements that really set medical training apart from other types of training.
Yeah, and I imagine those buildings were mostly in urban areas, were they?
Absolutely, because once it becomes clear that medical students are going to start working with clinical patients, then medical schools generally need to be in places where there's enough patient volume, which means that they're almost always in urban places.
Yeah. And it's just not something you think about, how cadavers will get into the dissecting labs.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So going into chapter 5, and it returns to the issue of students who were not white Protestant males, which made up the bulk of medical school students. So the minority students, particularly, again, female and Black students, and how they were receiving unequal treatment by medical colleges. And so we've got this phrase, hidden curriculum. What was the role of architecture in the so-called hidden curriculum of medical education?
So we already talked about the differences between the historically Black medical colleges and predominantly white institutions. In chapter 5, I changed the lens by looking at the hierarchies promoted by the architecture and the material culture, which is to say things like portraits and uniforms within the medical school campuses themselves. And so these certainly were environments that celebrated white Protestant men. There were elements like portraits that only celebrate white men, YMCA, Young Men Christian Association offices in the medical school building. These are sort of physical design elements, and then there's also how the buildings were used. For example, the Black student who was allowed a room in the medical school dormitory, but then no one would speak to him. Where I focus a great deal of my attention in peeling back this so-called hidden curriculum is looking at the rest spaces and the dormitories. So, for instance, at a variety of medical schools, the elite schools, struggling schools, predominantly white institutions, historically Black medical colleges, at a variety of medical schools, the women had smaller restrooms, locker rooms, and lounges that were also less public. So what this meant was that, you know, both men and women students had the same constellation of suites, typically a restroom or toilet room, a locker room, and a lounge. But the women's spaces were much smaller, and they usually only had one door leading to the suite, which made the suite less kind of visible, more private than the men's, which often had multiple entrances. And then sometimes they would actually take the entire women's suite and move it, far from the men's suite in a much less public part of the building. And so the result was that the women would be much less visible in the kind of general environment of the medical school than the male students. And sometimes people say to me, well, of course there were smaller locker rooms for women. Admissions in this period was limited for women. There were quotas. But again, the point is that once the small locker room for women is constructed, it then becomes prescriptive of future decisions. It's very easy to say, we can't have more women. We don't have the facilities. And people did say that. And so there's a long reach once these spaces are constructed in this way. The other piece to consider is that when we look within the locker rooms and lounges, the furniture reveals different expectations for the behaviors of women than for the men. So women's spaces might generally include things like rocking chairs or couches for the women to lie down on. Types of behaviors that were not expected of the men. There wasn't the same type of furniture in the room for the men. And the men's room often had things like ashtrays. There were going to be smoking spaces, you know, activities that were gendered male. And so it creates this real dichotomy. I also, on the same line, do a deep dive into dormitories for medical students and nurses respectively, and examine how the medical student dormitories were carefully crafted to emphasize autonomy and independence, which was a very different message than the ones projected by the nurses' dormitories. of course, then what becomes more complicated is if the nurses are female and the med students almost entirely male, what happens when we have women medical students? In the case of Columbia, they had a dedicated section of the medical student dormitory, but appear to have used the pool and exercise facilities in the nurses' dormitory rather than in the medical student dormitory. So these examples start to, I think, really give us a sense of how the physical environment promoted hierarchies related to race and gender, and also to profession, you know, nurse, dentist, pharmacist, physician within the medical school.
Yeah, and those really important nuances that you bring out about the rocking chair versus the smoking.
Right, right. I mean, yeah, it's layers upon layers to create these environments.
Yeah, exactly. Because they can say, look, we've provided a space to relax in for both of them.
Right.
What's the big deal? They're equal.
And yet they're two stories away and they're, you know, not in the main thoroughfare of the medical school.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So we've taken up a lot of your time today, Catherine, but I did want to ask you about the epilogue. And your study period began in 1893 and it ends in 1940. And you use the epilogue to contemplate today's world. So what did you discover when you compared the design of today's medical schools with that of medical school buildings a century or more ago?
As all of us would expect, it's no surprise that the building programs of schools constructed in the last 20 years are vastly different than the building programs from 100 years ago. You know, in the last 20 years, you're not going to find a museum. You're not going to find a central library. They probably have a digital commons instead. In many places, there's no more suite for embalming and storing cadavers. And definitely gone are wings and wings and wings of huge teaching laboratories, which were so critical 100 years ago. And these were cornerstones of design 100 years ago, and they don't exist anymore. They're not necessary. But what has remained remarkably consistent is the commitment of medical educators and architects to the idea that buildings participate in transforming medical training and shaping the identity of students. So although the conversations about what that means in terms of medical training and in terms of shaping the identity of students has changed, that belief is consistent. So themes today include things like cultivating interprofessional collaboration. I've seen spaces that are designed to bring nurses, physicians, social workers, pharmacists together, rather than this hierarchy that we were seeing 100 years ago. Now, whether that is successful, whether that is making the intended shift, that's a different conversation. But this belief in the ability of architecture to shape pedagogy and identity continues. Another example is creating spaces for students to collaborate, to have mentorship, you know, helping third year students mentor first year students. These, again, are ideas that become reflected in the building and then promoted by the space itself. At the same time, a number of schools are reconsidering who is being celebrated in the buildings. The result has been commissioning portraits of diverse faculty members, renaming spaces and organizations. There's a kind of growing awareness of the environment that's created. And I hope that by sort of peeling back what was created 100 years ago, it will help medical educators today to nuance these conversations, in no small part because almost all of the buildings that were built 100 years ago are the cornerstones of the academic medical centers that are still with us today, that are in place across American cities today. So these buildings are generally highly renovated, but still very much in use. And I think that there's a very kind of living legacy of a really rich and complicated moment. But what hasn't changed over the last 100 years is the aspirations of medical educators who want to use architecture to promote the latest pedagogy and the conception of physician identity.
Well, it's good to know there are still physical spaces being focused on and not just virtual spaces.
Oh, yes. Yes. That is true. That is true. They may be functioning very differently, but they still exist.
Yeah. Well, I hope medical educators and those involved in the design and the funding of designs will read your book. Again, everyone, it is Building Schools Making Doctors, Architecture and the Modern American Physician by Catherine L. Carroll. And Catherine, thank you so much for speaking. This is absolutely fascinating stuff.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Rachel. I've been really looking forward to it.